Okay, this is an interview with Tom White on October, 14th?
14th.
2001 with Angie Wood. So, do you want to talk about where you grew up and just a little bit of what you've done?
Okay, I was born in Longview, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up there, went to school there. I was, as a child, spent most of the time hunting, fishing, and trapping. I started work when I was at a regular job when I was 16. Is an auto mechanic, and then I bought a commercial fishing boat when I was 18, and then I left home I left Longview about a year after I graduated, and then I commercial fished out of Nia Bay up until 1965, I guess. At that time I was went into the service and got married shortly after that.
Mm-hmm.
And in this service, I was an infantry officer and an aviator. And I went to Vietnam in 68, 69 and flew gunships. And when I married in 66, I guess, and I had adopted my wife's daughter from a prior marriage. Had two children by that marriage, and that marriage ended in 87. And then I remarried in 90,
mm-hmm.
present wife, and acquired two kids from her, plus her and I adopted a third child. And I bought this business while I was still in service in 1974, and I got out of the service in 75. And came to operate this business. I first came to the island when I was still in the service in
1969.
And I built a house in Riviera.
How did you find out about the island? Did you have ties to it before?
No, I was just fishing around. I had a boat.
Uh-huh.
I lived in Olympia. I'd fished around. It was real pretty. And so I wondered how people lived there. So I found out, bought a piece of property, and moved out here.
Wow, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Who were some of the first people you met when you moved out here?
Bob Eric.
Mm-hmm.
And I became real close friends with him.
Yeah.
And spent all my free time hanging out with him in his shop, making stuff.
Tell me some about his machine shop. A few people have told me that they remember it and stuff. And
okay, the machine shop was his dad started the business in 1907.
Uh-huh.
And the business was located on Johnson Landing, which is down by John Cameron's house, where the cases have a house now.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a boat called the Vaughn that he brought produce and stuff, not produce, but I mean
groceries and hardware.
Hardware and stuff from Tacoma, and then he delivered it around to the people on the island. And then he would also pick up items, farm equipment, household goods that were broken, and he would take them back to his shop at Johnson's Landing, and he repaired things.
Oh.
And he also, the Vaughn also hauled eggs and produce from the island, vegetables and stuff, fruit to Tacoma, where it was
just
sold.
Just from the local island farmers?
From local island farmers. So he hauled stuff back and forth for Tacoma, so he was kind of the transportation for farm goods and for stuff out. So he had a kind of a general merchandise place and a repair place on that dock down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the lathe that's in the machine shop now, his father bought in 1911 for $495, which was a huge amount of money
during
those times, yeah. And
wow.
The lathe's still out there, still works.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I'd like to go and look at that when we're done here. When you acquired this place, you acquired it from him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go about doing that?
I was just down here. I'd lived here when I was stationed at Fort Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I attended college at St. Martin's College, I lived here and commuted back and forth. And Bob and I had become very good friends during that time. And then I was transferred to East Coast, and I was out here on vacation, because I had my house rented at Haddon Island, and I was out on vacation. We were staying at Eric's, and he went out in the shop one day, and he said, well, he says, I'm going to retire and turn this place over to you. And I said, well, I can't afford to buy this place. And he says, well, how much money could you come up with? And I said, about $10. So that's the down payment. He says, we'll work the rest out in payments.
Wow.
And so I says, are you serious? He says, yep. He says, I want you to have this place. So we did it. We were sitting in the kitchen in there and took a big piece of yellow paper. We wrote down how much money it was and how much the down payment was and what the payments were. And then we wrote it in the bottom half. We tore it in half. And we took half of it.
That was your contract.
That was
my
contract. And we used that contract for about 5 years.
The same one on the yellow piece of paper?
Yeah, that was all we had, you know. But the IRS finally made us get somebody to write a real contract, because they thought we were trying to cheat them out of money some way, because the contract was too vague.
Right.
But so we had Alan Billett wrote up a real contract for the IRS, but Bob and I used our yellow paper for the 20 years until it was paid for.
That's great. That's funny. He had pretty much already established a lot of the business already, right?
When I got here, his dad, you know, had done repair work and bought and sold stuff. And then when they got ferry service, they moved to that. They moved the business from there down to here. This house here belonged to another family, and he bought this house, and then they rebuilt the, modernized the house, rebuilt it, and they built the shop out here, and then later that little office building, which was a grocery store.
Oh, that was a grocery store?
That was a grocery store and a post office.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so Bob's dad and mom then ran the business here until his death, and then Bob and his mom ran it until her death, and shortly after her death, then Bob sold it to me.
Mm-hmm.
She was kind of the bookkeeper. She was, the employees said that she had little timers, like cooking timers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody would bring something down to be fixed, she would tell, like, Bob Bear to go fix that, and then she'd set this clock. And so when he'd come back with a fix, she knew exactly how many minutes he'd worked on it. You know, that's how much she was very...
Oh, very meticulous.
Very meticulous bookkeeper, and very meticulous about keeping track of every penny, you know?
Wow.
You know, so it was, apparently it was very successful, and...
Mm-hmm.
In operating the business and very astute in investing the money and.
So when she was gone,
yeah.
Everybody was pulling out their hair.
Yeah.
I bet.
So he was.
You don't really notice how much people like that do for you until they're not around anymore, huh?
And so I looking at the books and stuff, it appears that Bob didn't raise any after his mother died. He didn't change any of the prices. He used to save her price books, you know. He just kept on going that way, you know. He didn't change anything, you know.
Gotcha. It was working well for her. We're just not going to mess with it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. So, let's see. So what was going on when you first moved, or where was your first place that you lived out here?
Okay, I bought a lot up on the bluff on Seaview Drive, on Riviera, where McDermott lives now. Jim McDermott?
I think I know what you're talking about.
Anyway, and I borrowed some money and built a house there.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in that, and then I commuted by boat to Fort Lewis.
To Fort Lewis.
Every morning and every night. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to college off here, I did the same thing. I commuted by boat to Chambers Creek, and then I hitchhiked to St. Martin's every day.
Hitchhikes every day. Couldn't imagine doing that now. What was going on here?
As far as the business?
Not just the business, but island stuff.
Oh, well, Riviera started, I think there was, my house was about the seventh house, I think, in the development.
Uh-huh.
And they were still selling lots, and they had a boat that just brought passengers over from the marina, which now belongs to that, what's her name, where the guy was killed. You know, the guy was murdered over the time.
Yeah.
From that marina.
Uh-huh.
Used to be Chet, it was that time belonged to Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
Chet Palmer, and they'd bring boats over to the Riviera dock, and then they had a bunch of vans that they hauled the customers around and showed them the lots and the golf course.
Oh, that's how they did their real estate sales?
Yeah, and sold stuff, you know, and then they had, I think they would advertise, you know, you come out and you get a free meal or a gift or something, I don't know what, they'd run them around and sell those lots that way. So that was going on. There was still quite a bit of friction between the old-timers and the development. I mean, Hazel was quite upset with the development, the changing the island, you know.
Do you remember anything she had to say about that?
No, she was pretty hostile
about
Riviera, yeah. But it was kind of interesting because they were also peddling her books hand over fist for her, you know, at the same time, you know, she was Island and Sound, you know, like they were buying a lot of those and either selling them or giving them to their clients, using them as a sales thing. So she was making money off it, but she was not happy with the change.
Right. Any other people that express discontent with the whole idea?
I think there was, generally, my experience was that a lot of the old-timers didn't like the change, but then most of them liked the people that came out. you know, they became, people moved out and they liked them, you know, and they were particularly, there was not many young families on the island, you know, so when we moved out in 1669, well, we had Ginger was about 9 years old, and we had a, Amy was born right after that, you know.
Mm-hmm. To have kids on the island
and
was
so we
a
had,
little
we had this little baby, you know, and we'd go to the community club, you know, and all these little ladies that,
you know, all over the
yeah, they just loved having this little baby out here, you know.
Right.
So there was, you know, we were pretty warmly accepted by mm-hmm. the old-timers.
It's just the idea of having yeah. a housing development on the island.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of the, there was still a lot of people left who had been, who were children of original settlers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bessie Cameron was still alive, Hattie Johnson was still alive. You know, there was a lot of people who'd been there for a long, long time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, they, I never felt unwelcome here. There was a saying, it was hostility towards the development, but not against the people
not
so much.
Not against the people so
yeah.
much, right. what else can you tell me about what was going on the island? I mean, the stores or...
Okay, we had a...
Anything.
Let's see, when I first got here, I don't, the Riviera store wasn't open, I don't think. But Lyle Carlson had a store.
Mm-hmm.
And so you bought, we bought stuff down there. And it was kind of interesting. He had, at that time, he didn't have a cash register, so he would figure out by hand, you know, your bills. And also, he would order, he was very careful about ordering groceries, you know, so he would get to know whatever you, what you bought, he'd order that much, so he didn't like to waste any, buy stuff that was perishable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he would also hold stuff for you. You know, if you normally bought so many gallons of milk a week, well, he'd have that many gallons of milk for you, for your family. And he kept track of how much you'd gotten, you know. So if somebody came from off island and wanted to buy something, you know, he'd say, well, I don't have any of that. And he'd say, well, there's some right there. He'd say, oh, that's for my customers, he'd say.
That's for the customers.
And he would refuse to, you know, he would actually not sell some of the stuff that he had in the store because he knew that his regular customers needed it, you know. So he kept pretty good track of,
oh, wow.
of what, you know, your regular people bought from him, you know. It was very interesting.
Wow, that's neat. Huh. And if you came back and you normally had 4 gallons of milk a week and got your fifth, was he a little stirred?
No, he wasn't stirred about it. He just might not have it.
He just might not have it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. And I don't think he used banks because he always had big gobs of cash. I remember one time telling him, you shouldn't be carrying that much cash around. You know, he had a big reach to his butt to get
pocket.
Some, yeah, to try to get some, make some change for a bigger bill, you know, and he's just got this big gob of 50s and 100s and,
Jeez.
He's
burying it in the backyard.
But anyway, his family had lost, his parents lost a lot of money in the Depression, so he was very distrustful of banks. So I don't know if,
uh-huh.
I'm not sure if he even used a bank or what he did. It was all cash, I don't know.
Huh.
But anyway, he carried an alarming amount of cash around that was very disturbing to me. I'd face somebody to come out here and kill him.
Kill him and get his money. Yeah, that is kind of scary.
Mm-hmm. He got an adding machine or a cash register that added things up on a tape, you know,
mm-hmm.
and but he didn't trust it. So he would, when you got your groceries, he'd ring up, you know, so much for this, so much for that, and the tape would, and he'd look at the total, and then he'd take his pencil and paper, and he'd add it all up, and he'd hold them, yep, same thing, and then he'd charge that much. He wouldn't trust that fancy machine.
So he's just doing it for the purpose of having a receipt,
yeah.
kind of?
Well, no, I think he bought it, but he wasn't really sure.
He wasn't
that,
really sure
that,
if he...
That could do it right, you know, so he'd check it with his pencil paper.
That's funny. Have you ever heard anything about John Lohr?
John Lohr?
Mm-hmm.
Across the bay?
The one that had the still on the south end of the island.
John Lohr?
Mm-hmm.
I thought Lohr's was across on... No, the...
They were supposed to be by, kind of by on Amsterdam Bay.
The bootlegger was where Cindy lives, but his name wasn't Lohr. It was, I've forgotten his name now, but he lived where Cindy lives.
Yeah.
The bootlegger.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but his name wasn't John Lohr.
The Gordons told me it was John Lohr, but...
I don't think so. John Lohr, I think, was, he was a grandparent or uncle or something to Munson. And he had a...
Wait, who are Munson's again?
Remember Munson's had the Anderson house?
Yes, okay.
Okay, and he was John Cavanaugh, and he was Thelma Cavanaugh's son.
Mm-hmm.
And now the Lohrs had a marina over on the Nisqually Flats,
mm-hmm.
where they rented boats to duck hunters and fishermen and stuff. And in fact, I when they went, after they were out of business, I went over there and bought a bunch of boats, and we towed them to Anderson Island, towed a whole string of them over here. And we had one here that was called the Queen Mary because it was the largest of the boats from the Lure Landing. And it was a big wooden lap-straked boat, a wooden plank boat. And they used it to go out at night to pick up the boats that didn't get in after at dark, you know, that maybe got too far out or broke down.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had a bunch of smaller, just regular wooden rowboats, and we brought, they were distributed all over the island. There was a lot of them.
Huh.
Munson's had some, and
wow.
I don't know where they've had any of them left.
I wonder who the bootlegger is then.
Oh, gosh.
I wonder if they might have just gotten the name wrong or something.
God, dang, I cannot remember. If I think of it, Cindy might know.
Mm-hmm.
Or Sylvia, but it wasn't John Lewis. Somebody, I think it was some. Mabel Jolson was telling me about him.
Yeah.
Yeah, the bootlegger, where he lived down there.
What did she say about it?
Yes, he made bootleg liquor down there.
Have you ever heard any stories about the beer tree?
About the what?
The beer tree.
Uh-uh.
It's supposed to be up or near Johnson's Landing on the top of the hill of Eckingstam Johnson. No idea about that.
A beer tree, what was it for?
Apparently... the Johnsons and Ernie Eric, I guess, would make a homebrew during the Prohibition and would stash it in this tree, and so that the people coming home to their wives didn't have to go all the way down the hill and back up the hill with their horses to get their drink before they went home to their wives. So they could stop at the tree and leave their cash and take their drink.
I know Bob said his dad used to take a beer down at the clubhouse in the back of a, I don't know if it was a van, it might have been that 14-reel van he was restoring, but it had a covered back, and he'd have the beer in the back of that, you know, and the guys would slip out of the dance and go out in the back of this van and have a few snorts and go back inside.
Gail had talked about, when she was little, remembering that there was a lot of going out to the car at the dances and then coming back, and they weren't walking quite as straight as when they had left. That's funny. Speaking about drinking, what can you tell me about the ferry crew and the captains?
Well, when I first came to the island, there was a lot of drinking on the ferry, particularly on holidays. You know, a lot of it was patrons would have alcohol in the car. You know, they'd be giving the crew drinks too, but, you know, sometimes they got pretty drunk.
Smashed.
And one time what was his name? Carl Carlson was coming home one night, and the boat started, I wasn't on the boat then, but he's telling me about it, but the boat started going around in circles, and somebody goes, once he crawled up the wheelhouse, the skipper was laying on the floor, passed out. And so Carl brought the boat up to the dock so he could go home. And another time, this was pretty recently, this was probably within 15 years ago maybe, the ferry came up to the dock, and the crew had been drinking, and they didn't tie the boat up, and while the ferry was loading, the boat backed out of somebody bumped it up, the wheelhouse bumped the thing into gear, and it backed up out of the slip, and one of the cars on the ramp backed up and hit a car behind him, this was on the old dock, but it had cables on it. And they had quite a bit of slack in the cables, too, because they weren't drinking, weren't paying attention, and so when the boat fell out, the ramp dropped down, snapped all the cables and everything, and dropped the
apron right
into the water. But the crew then just took off. They just took off for Stilica. Well, they left one of the crew guys here on the dock, and the guy was up on the dock. He was on the ramp, so he got left here, and the crew went off, and half the cars here and half of them, two of them mashed together and went back to town. So anyway, I called the county and talked to what's the engineer's name for the county?
Don Peterson,
you know. And he said, how come they did that? I said, I don't know, why don't you talk to your crew member? He said, what's he doing here? I said, well, they left him here. So he talked to this guy for a minute, and then the crew member came back and said, he wants to talk to you. And Peterson says, what's the matter with that guy? I said, what do you think's the matter with him? He's stone drunk, he can't talk.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Do you have any ferry boat stories, any other funny ferry boat stories? Or not necessarily funny, but... I mean, you have kids, so I'm sure you have lots of...
Well, one time we had a guy came out here, was a biker, and he carried a great big 45 on his hip. Well, on the Tahoma, we had it had a little heater, oil, kind of stinky, remember it? Oil stinky?
I never.
It had an oil burner upstairs, and it was very stinky. And everybody was standing around that to get warm, because there wasn't much heat on the boat. And so everybody was standing around in the morning, and this
biker guy
came up with his big 45 on his hip, you know. And so I told him a story about my grandfather that says, you know, I asked him, I says, if you got, my grandfather told me this story when he'd give me a gun one time. So I said, the same guy, I said, if you got the front sight filed off that gun? And he says, well, no, why would I want to do that? And I says, well, if you carry a handgun around, says, sooner or later somebody will take it away from you and shove it up your ass. And if you take the front sight, it won't hurt so bad. Of course, everybody just started laughing, you know, and this guy's a real tough guy. So he went down, he stood downstairs in the rain, or in the cold, all the way across. He wouldn't talk to his head up there anymore.
That's funny. Oh, dear.
But we had, for a while, when I first got here, we had several incidents with, we had another couple of other guys that had carried guns around their hips, you know, and did a lot of drinking, you know, and I was up at the, I maintained the landfill, and I was working up there one day, and they got up there, and they were shooting, and they would, the one guy put a beer down on top of his car, and his friend shot the beer off the top of the car right next to his hand, you know, they were just shooting wild over there, you know.
Scary.
And threatening people with their guns that come in there, you know, and so I, at that time, John Cammon's dad, Russ Cammon, was kind of the law officer out here, representative for the deal, so I was getting him up there and trying to get these guys calmed down.
Get these guys to stop.
They were wild, waving guns and drunk, so we finally just left, got everybody out there, just left them up there. Just leave them alone.
Nice.
There were two brothers, I can't remember their name now, McCarkey brothers or something, I don't remember the name.
Do you remember Clarence?
Yeah, oh yes.
Do you have anything you can tell me about Clarence and...
Clarence and Elmer and Dolly were, you know, real alcoholics. I mean, just terrible alcoholics. And, well, I remember one time Clarence's car broke. He called and went out to get his car, you know, and it had stalled on a hill, and he just put a case of beer underneath the back wheel, you know, so it wouldn't roll down the hill. And he tells me, he says, yeah, he says, I always carry a case of beer in a car. He says, it makes a good wheel chock for your car in case it breaks down on a hill.
Right.
But apparently, it was Clarence and somebody else. One of the drinking buddies, this was long before I was here, it's a story I heard, I don't know how true it is. But anyway, there was a guy died, and they had a funeral, and buried him in the cemetery, and I believe it was Clarence and some other guy. They got drunk and missing their friends. They dug him up and set him up, tried to give him a drink after the
drink. Are you serious?
The funeral, yeah.
That's hilarious.
And Clarence lived here for a while. He, his daughter, he had a piece of property down here on, you know where the couple lives now with those big black dogs?
Oh, where Wooders
live? Yeah, okay, he owned that place. And his family originally lived on McNeil Island, and it had come out by covered wagon, I guess, to McNeil Island. And he gave me his dad's tool chest, which is out here in the office, a wooden tool chest that his dad was a carpenter, I guess. I've got that. And then I also bought from him the tractor, the Fortson tractor that their family had. So it's up in the car barn. But anyway, he lived down there and just drank. And at one time, apparently, he had quite a bit of money. He owned a hotel one time in town that... One of his drunken girlfriends got away from him, and he kept, you know, he owned property and kept selling it. You know, he just kind of went downhill from the alcohol. But anyway, this daughter came out and tried to get the last of his property, you know. She was trying to get him in an old soldier's home and institutionalized or something. And so at about that time, then, he ended up town. He got mugged up on Pacific Avenue. He got beat up, was in the hospital, you know. So I went to the hospital to see him, and he wanted to come back to Ireland, and she was trying to, in the meantime, I guess she either sold or took possession of the house while he was in the hospital. So he
did. Oh, really? So he didn't...
Maybe she sold it, I guess, anyway. So he had no place to go when he wanted to come back to the island. And she wanted to put him in some kind of an old soldier's home.
Yeah, Gail said that he was in the old soldier's home in Ording.
Yeah, so anyway, so I brought him, he said he didn't want to go there, and I said, well, I brought him home. Well, I brought him home and said, you know, but you can't drink. You can live in my house as long as you don't drink. He lived up in an apartment there. And he became very attached to Kirsten. He and Kirsten got along really well. And he was doing fine. He started building a, he was going to make a saw. He started putting together a bunch of stuff from an old sawmill that was up behind his place. He drug all this stuff down, and he had, he was going to make a sawmill that made a fir shingles. He was going to make fir shingles and treat them. Mm-hmm. And this was going to be a new product. He was quite a brilliant man when he was, mm-hmm. he was very smart. So he's going to make these fir shingles, treated fir shingles, and start the shingle business here on the property.
Right, on the property, huh?
While he was living here. Well, he did good for several months, and then one day a friend of his came out, some old drinking buddy.
Uh-oh.
And Clarence walked off down the ferry dock, and he came back. He didn't come back. He wouldn't, he was ashamed to come back, you know, he didn't mm-hmm. want, and he particularly was really embarrassed about it. Didn't want Kirsten to know he'd start drinking again. But anyway, so he started drinking again and really went downhill again.
Huh.
Real bad. So the only time I ever known he was sober was a few months that
wow.
he was here.
Wow.
But interesting man when he was really
he was
interesting.
Sober.
Yeah. He was telling me that in World War II, he didn't smoke, you know. He mm-hmm. said he quit smoking in World War II, and I said, well, what happened? He said, well, he says, I think it was on one of the islands, anyway. So we got on, you know, we landed this island, and we said we'd been out of cigarettes for a long time. We got into this Japanese cave, and there was they had stuff hidden there, you know. And so we got some Japanese wine and also these cigarettes, you know. And so we drank on this wine like mad, and we smoking these, the cigarettes. He said had been damp in this cave, and they were moldy. And he says they got really sick on this wine and these moldy cigarettes. He says I never smoked again. He says, but it never stopped me from drinking, I guess.
Oh, that'd be awful. Can you tell me anything about Ivo?
Yeah, Ivo was a saint.
Yeah.
He was a really, really, really nice man. One of the nicest people I ever met in my life, I think. He came down, I think, I'm not sure when, but mm-hmm. when he was a young man, he moved to the island. He worked, I think, a lot for the Baskets up there. Mm-hmm. The Basket Farm was where Hazel lives. And he was a brush picker. And you know, his wife was pretty severely handicapped.
Who was his wife?
Pearl.
Pearl?
Yeah. And then he had a daughter who was fine, then he had a son that was severely handicapped.
I didn't know that Pearl was handicapped.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And so he, you know, became kind of a caretaker, taking care of his wife and his son.
And
then when they were, his son stayed in a, what's up at Buckley? What's the name of this home for mentally?
I don't know.
Anyway, he had some kind of I think it was a birth defect type mm-hmm. mental retardation with some other health problems. Not expected to, well, they didn't expect to live very long.
Live.
Yeah, but he did. He lived up to about 40, I think, before he died.
Wow.
But when his son died, his son's name was Glenn. When Glenn died, the chaplain, whatever, from this. What was the name of that home he stayed in? I don't know. Anyway, came out to the funeral, and he was telling me that Ivo mailed Glenn a letter every day with a dollar in it. So every day that Glenn got mail from his dad with a dollar bill in it. So he always had money for the vending machine.
For the vending machine.
Yeah, which I thought, you know, and the guy said, you know, that was so important to him. Every day that Ivo did, you know, neat things like that. Well, another interesting story is when he, you know, his house was down there on. You know where Papa Bear used to live?
Yeah.
Okay, right next door to that.
Oh, okay.
That little house up there. And they got a TV set. And so they were trying to get the TV to work, you know. So Ivo was up on the roof and Pearl was down below in front of the TV, and he kept holding the thing up and turning it. No picture. And tried everything, you know. Couldn't get a picture or anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So finally he got mad and he just threw the thing off the roof and it lit in the big blackberry bushes around the opposite side of Bear's house.
Yeah.
And she says, right there. So anyway, that TV antenna laid in those blackberry bushes for years, and they had perfect reception.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, Ivo was Doug Wells too. Was
uh-huh.
You know, hand dug wells, and there was a lot of hand dug wells. There's still a few left, but there was a lot of abandoned ones when I first came to the island. You know, that people didn't use anymore. That were stuck around the woods. Anyway, he knew a lot of them were,
mm-hmm.
and when he picked brush. To keep his brush fresh, he would bundle it up and he'd take it on a rope and he'd lower it down inside these abandoned wells. And he used them for refrigerators to keep his brush fresh when he took the town. That's kind of clever.
Yeah, that's cool.
And well, anyway, as Ivo, after his daughter had grown up and left, his daughter caused him a lot of grief when she was teenager.
Uh-huh.
She got involved with drugs and alcohol. And, well, one time her and her boyfriend took his credit cards and put him
in
huge debt, you know. Anyway, so but she turned out to be fine when she grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a daughter named Sheila, who he was very fond of. But anyway, after his family was gone, well, he started to take an interest in taking care of old people, but usually it was people that nobody would go near.
Mm-hmm.
Like one was this alcoholic lady that was just a mess, you know, and just nobody could stand her, you know. Well, I would take her to town and make sure she had her medicine, you know. And but he would take care of these people with no condemnation. If they wanted to drink, that was fine. He mm-hmm. didn't ask anything. He just took accept them where they were at.
Mm-hmm.
And let him meet their needs. You know, he'd, you know, buy groceries at the store out of his own pocket for them, and he'd,
wow.
you know, just make sure.
And that some, they were okay.
And some of these people were nasty. I mean, there was the one lady that lived behind this, I won't say any names, was real nasty. And the other one that used to live up here next to Hazel,
mm-hmm.
I mean, was just a nasty, dirty, old, drunken lady, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And mean to everybody, and I would just love these people and took care of them, you know. And he had a number of people he took care of that way. You know, so he was, you know, just a kind of a natural caretaker.
Yep.
But with, you know, no restrictions, and you know, he just took them where they were, and
mm-hmm.
took care of what they needed. Wonderful man, just a nice, nice man.
Wow, that's really special. You don't find people that
no.
would take an interest in people.
No,
at all.
These are people that nobody would touch. You know, mm-hmm. nobody would go near. Well, he would seem to find them and take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had a pretty hard life all his life. One of the first times I met him, you know, I says, "Don't you take." I'd gotten a ride with him or something. He was working on the ferry then. And I said, "Don't you take your keys out of the car?" And he says, "No." He says, "You know, somebody might need to use it." That's one of the first, when I first came to the island, I remember telling him, "Man, it's a nice place to live."
Someone might need
it. When he worked on the ferry, also, the kids got along really well with him. But mm-hmm. every Friday, he always had candy for all the kids.
Oh, that's cool.
So when they came home from school Friday, you know, he had candy for all the school kids.
Oh, that's great. Do you remember Christine Anderson much?
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me about her?
Well, she was born on the island, mm-hmm. you know, so never married, and had a bad leg that she'd broke, I guess, as a child, had her whole life. She says that it told me that the Indians used to come over and dig clams in our bay.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come in canoes when she was a girl from Indian women from Nisqually.
Oh, wow.
To dig clams in the bay. She had a really good memory.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going up there one time, she says she wanted me to dig up her sup tank, see if it was all right. And I said, "Well, you know where it is?" And, you know, she says, "Yeah, it's right there, you know, there's no sign, you know." Says, well, and so I dug down, and I said, "How'd you know where it was?" She said, "Well, I was here when they put it in." I said, "When they put it in?" She said, "Oh, about 50 years ago."
Oh, my goodness.
She remembered exactly where it was.
Where it was, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah.
I can't think much about her. Her brother,
mm-hmm.
he was still alive when I came here. I thought he was very vigorous. I thought he was about 60 years old.
Yeah.
And then I remember that he died suddenly, had a heart attack on the boat, and I found out he was over 80, but I couldn't believe it. He used
wow.
to run around the island in the wintertime with his shirt sleeves on a tractor, you know, with no
no
hat,
on,
no coat,
nothing.
No nothing, you know. He was
just go, too.
Very vigorous guy, yeah.
Huh. Can you tell me anything about Papa Bear? I mean, I know he worked for you and stuff,
yeah.
so.
Yeah, he first was a caretaker for the
Hopkins Ranch
up there.
Mm-hmm.
For Mrs. Hopkins. There was another name, and there's two names in it. What's the other name? Hopkins and
I can't remember.
The other ones. Anyway, he worked up there, and then when the development came, he started working for Eric. And well, Eric says that when he worked here, his wife Sylvia had asked Bob Bear to do something. And Bob Bear's got his car and went home, didn't come back for a year, you know. And the reason he went home is because he only worked for one boss.
One boss.
And it wasn't a woman.
Well,
so Bob said it took him a year to get him back after that. And when they first worked, I guess when they first came out, they were pretty hard pressed, you know. They used to eat a lot of raccoon. They used to grind raccoon meat up and make spaghetti and stuff with it, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I guess they were pretty hard pressed. When I first bought the business, well, Bob Bear says, you know, he would give me 3 months to see how I did, whether he'd let me know if he's going to stay or not. he gave me notice right away, you know, he wasn't going to work for me unless it was to his liking.
Uh-huh.
You know, he became very fond of me, he was very protective of me,
yeah.
You know, about making sure I didn't try to do something to get hurt or something, you know, with equipment and stuff, because I'd never done any of that before.
Uh-huh.
And I remember my brother-in-law one time came out and had been hanging out with us, you know, and he says, you know, Papa Bear is the boss's mom. He mothers you. So he really did. He was very protective of me and, you know,
uh-huh.
Really very supportive of me once we became really close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And when he had a really hard time when his wife died. He was really dependent upon her.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not, when she was dying, you know, she kept wanting me to get him to sit down so she could talk about money and about where things were and how to do things, you know, and he would just... Wouldn't do it.
We didn't want any part of...
You know, she's not going to die. I'm not going to do that, you know. So
uh-huh.
He was pretty devastated with her death and pretty unable to...
cope with
it. Yeah, you know,
everything.
But luckily one of his daughter-in-laws came out and was able to sort out stuff and get it. But his... well, Gary helped make his tombstone.
My dad?
Your dad helped make the tombstone for a little while. I'm pretty sure it was Gary. Bob and Gary made it with rocks.
Mm-hmm.
That's your dad. I'm pretty sure they did. But anyway, he had her ashes. She was cremated, and then Bob made a container for the ashes, and it was with a lid that came off.
Mm-hmm.
Then inside that was the ashes, and then my instructions were that when we went up together, Bob and I buried this, and it was
mm-hmm.
so tender. I mean, he dug the hole for this, you know, and he put down and he patted the dirt in very careful and sifted the rocks out, put it all around it, you know, and a tear rolling down his face. I mean, I would just bawl, and you know, he was so.
Mm-hmm.
So, because such, you know, he's such a rough old grudge budget,
and
all this tenderness, you know, of burying
know.
This wife, you know. Anyway, and the reason this thing came apart was because when he died, I was supposed to dig that back up, put his ashes in the box with her ashes, and stir them together and put it all back together.
Oh, how sweet is that?
And so that's how he's buried.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So not near as tough as this, is he acted a lot.
How do people respond to his gruff exterior?
Well, some people were defended by him, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, he would, you know, holler. And some people irritated him, you know. He would get, you know, very mad about something, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I remember we had a customer came down and wanted some work done, you know. And he thought it was too expensive, so he went and got somebody else, you know. Well, then somebody else, the other person he got started doing the work, well, then they got it, they ran into some problems, didn't know how to do it, and couldn't get the job done.
Uh-huh.
So this guy comes back and starts asking us how to do it, you know. And Bob Bear says, "Don't tell him, you son of a bitch. If you wanted it done right, you should have hired us in the first place. Now get the hell out of here." Chase the guy off the place, you know. So he could be real, real crusty when he got.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Well, another funny story. When Kirsten was, she must have, when I first got her, she was just a toddler anyway. And she came running across the parking lot out here, and she fell, and kind of just, you know, a little kid, running wide open, falling into the crushed gravel, you know, and she's
yeah.
all cut, and Papa was running over to her, you know, and he picks her up, and he's patting her, "Oh, goddamn, poor baby, did you hurt your fucking self?" You know, he's just saying these awful words, you know, and I says, "Papa," I said, "look how you're talking to that baby." You know, and he's, "huh?" He had, you know, no idea. But he was talking baby talk with all these square words, you know, trying to comfort her, you know. Well, you know, he had no idea that he talked like that, I don't think, you know.
Oh, that's hilarious.
He also played guitar.
Uh-huh.
You know, he liked country western music.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if other workers would put on music that wasn't country western, he'd just unplug the radio or turn it off.
Don't
want to
listen to that.
He was intolerant of anything but country western on the job site.
That's how about Mama Bear's dairy and little business that she ran from the house?
Yeah, she had ice cream and milk and stuff, and then she also was a notary public.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very a rule person, you know. Rules were rules. And you had to go by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time I went down, when I first got here, I had to change my registration to vote or something, you know. I had to
mm-hmm.
go down there, and she did that too, you know. When I first went down, and she had me stand at attention, you know, check me out and raise your right hand, you know, she did it right by the book, you know, you know, which nobody ever does, you know.
Right.
And then another time, you know, like the paychecks, you know, would Papa would just take the paycheck and give it to Mama, and that was,
mm-hmm.
you know, he never touched money at all. Well, anyway, I needed something notarized, so I gave it to Papa to take home that night and have her notarize it and bring it back.
Bring it
you
back.
Know. Well, she, man, oh man, she called the phone and said, "Don't you ever try that on me again." She says, "You're supposed to be standing in front of me when I notarize this. I can't do this without seeing your signature." I said, "Well, you see my signature every week on this page." "I don't care." She says, "You're supposed, the law says." She would not bend 1 minute.
Not a single bit of wavering there.
And she also had rules on Bob's drinking. See, Bob couldn't drink till after 5 o'clock on a weeknight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on Saturdays, he could drink after 12 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
At noon, but he had to do
everything before
that, you know. So she had, you know, he drank, but she had all these rules that made it very kept
right.
things from ever getting out of control.
Huh.
Kind of cute.
That's funny.
And she's also a real health food nut, you know. She had alfalfa and all this kind of stuff, you know, that you're supposed to eat.
It's funny. The only thing I really remember about Mama Bear is just my mom would go down there for milk and eggs once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would show us around her yard mm-hmm. what new stuff was growing. And
yeah,
stuff.
She liked to guard both of them, didn't
yeah. they? And they would, and mm-hmm. every once in a while they'd dig something up for us to take home.
Mm-hmm.
And then my favorite part was the toilet with the
flowers in it.
The flowers in it.
Yeah.
That was pretty hilarious. And I'd get a popsicle before mm-hmm. we went home. But I don't know, she always seemed like a really mm-hmm. caring person to mm-hmm. me. And I remember I didn't like Papa Bear when I was little, really little.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like him at all until he brought me my first load of sandbox sand. Then he could do no wrong. Oh my, he was the coolest person ever. But I don't know, that's all I can remember about them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Let's see. How did you become the gravedigger for
them? Well, Rudy Johnson, I guess, was a gravedigger. He dug them with shovels. And when Bob Eric got a backhoe, I guess he took over the job
mm-hmm.
digging graves. And so I just came in about the
when
business.
When you bought the business, you became the
business,
gravedigger.
I became the gravedigger.
Huh.
Yeah, you know, it used to be the joke that the backhoe dug the garbage pit, dug the graves, and dug the septic tanks.
And whoever has it gets all the jobs with it. There's no negotiations.
Huh. The first lady I buried was Bessie Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I got the business.
Hmm. What's it like having that kind of responsibility about being a grave digger? I mean,
it's fine.
Yeah, something you do.
Yeah, something you do. And it's, you know, different families have different things they want, you know. You
mm-hmm.
try to, but I've had one woman, when she buried her father, she had her children came out and she wanted to participate in it. She wanted to help dig? She wanted to be there to dig and to cover it up so that they actually knew what were a part of it.
Where
like
it
her
going.
Kids, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the kids had shovels and they helped, you know.
Oh, wow.
You know, of course some people don't want to see the dirt at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you just have to kind of figure out what they want and do it.
Right. Uh-huh. Hmm. How long have you been the grave
digger? Since 1975.
Let's see. How about the community club? What kind of stuff went on there when you first came out?
Yeah, it was quite a bit of activities when I first got here, you know, and they would have, you know, dances. They used to have a lot of dances. They had square dancing and just regular dances, you know, where they'd have
all kinds of music.
Yeah, people bring records and,
mm-hmm.
or I guess it was records, and maybe it was tapes.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they'd bring the stuff and people would dance mm-hmm. late in the night. You know, everybody would come. You know, older people would come and watch, and the whole community came. You know,
yeah.
And they were a lot of fun, and a lot of potlucks there. You know,
mm-hmm.
and you know that at that point, almost the entire community could get into the clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So just about everybody came. You know, Mabel Jolson didn't come very often, and Rupert Berg family, they didn't come a lot, but, you know, pretty much everybody came to those things.
Most of the families?
Yeah.
Huh.
And, you know, I really enjoyed them. It was real fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, like I said earlier, you know, Amy was just a little thing. They just passed her around. All these little ladies would sit along on the side of the dance hall and passing this baby around. You know, they loved having a baby on island. They apparently hadn't been any for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. So how's it different now? How do you think that, or how do you view the community club usage now as compared to what it was then?
Well, it's, you know, it's split up, you know, between the churches and the
mm-hmm.
Riviera and the community club, you know, and of course this has gotten too big.
Mm-hmm.
The community island's gotten too big for
too
the size,
big for
of, the hall,
size
so
of the hall,
so you can't really do this. Anything you try to do, something gets so crowded, you can't.
Right.
It's not fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
a lot of people don't come to, like, even the Christmas programs for the kids anymore. It's too stuffy and
you can't sit and you can't see, you can't hear, and it's just, you know, it's just too many. It's just crowded too hard.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot more intimate when it was a smaller group in there. You know, the building was big and the kids could run loose on the floors and you know. Probably 50 people was a big crowd.
Gail said she had come, when she came and they would do their community dances, that her favorite part when she was little was when they waxed the floor at intermission because
they used to sprinkle this stuff on her, it was real slippery.
They're in sliding her socks and she was just the happiest kid ever.
That was fun because everybody came, and there was no drinking allowed in there. They're real strict about that.
Mm-hmm. But in the cars, it's different, right?
So in the parking lot, or stand out behind the clubhouse, and the drinking all took place out there. But
the
kids inside
didn't see any of that.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Everybody smoked in there. It'd get real smoky in the wintertime sometimes.
Yeah. When the windows were open.